Hi, my name is Harry Ross, and I'm co-writer of 13 Steps to Teacher Empowerment, and I teach at National Lewis University, which is a very large teacher education university in the Chicago area.
And I'm Steve Zemelman, co-author with Harry, and I work here in Chicago on helping to start new schools, innovative schools in the city, and helping schools to improve, especially by helping instructional leadership teams work together.
I'm Alex Marunchuk, and I'm a math teacher and a bilingual department chair at a Chicago public high school.
I'm Julie Ross, no relation to Harry, and I teach at Baker Demonstration School in Wilmette, Illinois, and I teach fourth and fifth grade.
So we wrote this book called 13 Steps to Teacher Empowerment because we wanted to give teachers some ideas and some tools that could really help them feel more in control of their professional lives and to feel also less like passive victims of all the arbitrary mandates and things that come at us in the education world and less victims of some of the other forces that can get in the way of good teaching. And we wanted to help teachers using this book to see that really any teacher can use actions that are maybe just small everyday things or larger efforts in their school to help them really make connections with colleagues and make those connections more satisfying and make the school more successful.
We learned a lot about how to do this from smart teachers like Julie and Alex. And so we told a lot of their stories in the book. But we thought it would be really helpful for you to hear about some of their strategies right from the teachers themselves. So we're going to ask them about some of the things we've done and some of the ideas in the book that have been useful for them. We want them to talk about how they've come to view themselves as active individuals engaged in the professional lives of their schools rather than just hidden away behind the closed doors of their classrooms. So without more ado, our first question is, why in the world is it useful and important to take an active role with your fellow teachers? What does it do for you? Isn't it just more work, or isn't it just good enough to make your classroom the best it can be?
I think it's important and actually critical to talk to one another in a building. You're absolutely right that you can be your own island and treat your kids well, develop relationships, have them lead them through a successful year. But it's more powerful to work with others and to hear their ideas. It becomes more of a dynamic exchange. And I'm constantly learning every time I talk to somebody about a lesson or a kid or a parent or a family. I'm learning more and able to apply more to my classroom.
I think it's also a good example to set for your students. You know, if I'm collaborating with other teachers, if I'm going to ask for help, if I'm asking somebody to evaluate me or just, you know, a question, then my students can learn from that. And if I want them to be, you know, a learner, then I have to be one too.
So, you know, one way that a teacher can be more active really to start with is just to begin learning more about your kids, trying to understand more what's happening with them in their lives and in their learning, and then perhaps sharing that with other teachers in your building. So I'm wondering if there's some way that, Alex, that you've done that?
On a grand scale, there's a software that me and my department uses called DataLink that collects data on every exam that we give. So the students put their ID number in the Scantron, and then when I run data, it gives me what percentage of students answered a particular answer choice. So what percent of the students picked A, what percent of students picked B. So then I can go to individual students and do, you know, some unteaching. So if there's a particular misconception that they had and I hadn't realized that they had, now I can tell that they have it.
We do a couple different things too in fourth and fifth grade. Every Monday morning the kids go around and we share something for the weekend, so we're developing relationships and learning what they do outside of school. We have dialogue journals with our kids. So since there's two teachers in the classroom, we take half, and we maintain a dialogue about maybe more personal one-on-one issues, and they're getting to know us as well. And we have a Star of the Week where a student is highlighted and brings in, you know, special things and talks about things they're proud of and that sort of thing.
So teachers can really benefit from having some time to reflect on how things worked or didn't work on a particular day and what it all means and where they're going, what else they want to learn, and so forth. And yet there's also, it's hard for teachers to find the time for that. And Alex, perhaps you have some suggestions on how you get that to work for yourself.
Right, the time is definitely an issue. And I think you have to do a lot of prep in order to even set that time aside. So you have to do a lot of prep for the beginning of the year. Like, so one of the things that I do is at the beginning of the year, I make a folder for every day of the week, and then I make a folder for every week of the school year. And then at the end of the week, every week, I try to look through what we did that week and collect one, you know, worksheet or one activity from every day of the week, put it in a binder, and then put notes on what got accomplished, what didn't get accomplished, you know, what I want to do next week. And then, you know, that's an ongoing weekly process. One of the teachers that was really good at this is one of my colleagues, Sarah, and she had this binder. We call it the Sarah binder because she was just so good. You know, she would put all her activities for the week into one sheet protector with a lesson plan on top. And so for next year, you know, in the following years, we would always go to Sarah and say, hey, do you have notes from last year about how that went? Because I'm going to teach it again, and I can't remember, you know, how it went, but I know that you take notes every week, so you have a really good record of what went well and what didn't. So I'm really trying hard to do it this year.
To do your Sarah binder.
Right, to do my Sarah binder. I just think it's so beneficial, especially if you're teaching the same subject over and over. I mean, obviously you don't want to teach the same thing over and over, but there's some activities that are so good in theory, and then in action, there's some things that, you know, need to be changed, but if you don't remember that for next year, then you have the same exact pitfalls, and you're like, oh, yes, the same thing happened last year. If only I had written it down.
Yeah.
And then you make the same mistake again.
Exactly, exactly. Especially with different curriculums. Like at our school, you know, it's a different curriculum every year. So there's some lessons that, you know, regardless of the curriculum, are just good lessons that you want to stick with. And so you want to have them somewhere where they're ready, you know, at all times for you to take advantage of, regardless of, you know, the curriculum.
And it shows why it's so important, too, to collaborate, because different teachers have different skills. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was the one who always needed to borrow the Sarah binder.
It's a great binder.
And Sarah, I still am.
I'm wondering how much time it takes to do that and how you find that time. Or maybe with those folders, maybe it's easy. You can just chuck the stuff in there, scribble a note, move
right.
on. What
well, again, that like? I mean, it takes preparation. So if you have a detailed lesson plan, you know, at the beginning of the week, then you just put that lesson plan in front of all your activities, and then you can just jot down a couple of notes. But if you don't plan in advance, then you have to write, you know, a whole paragraph about how things went. So I think if the preparation is put in, then it's very fast. You know, it's just at the end of the week on Friday. I know we all want to go home on Friday, but, you know, right before you leave, look at your detailed lesson plan, make a little note, you know, this didn't really work, this went so well, you know, definitely doing it again. And then it just takes 5 seconds to pull all the sheets from Monday through Friday and then take them all and put them into the week one folder. And then it kind of, you know.
Yeah. I just think the other thing about this that to me is important is that, I mean, these are just things that an individual can do, but each one of them is kind of adding to a person's control over their professional life. And, I mean, the example of sharing it is the way then it starts to help make a difference for your colleagues and in a way that they're going to appreciate. And so you're contributing, you know, to the whole school by doing that.
That's
what we're about here.
Right. It sounds like you're going to be the next Sarah, though, and there's going to be somebody in a year or two who's going to be able to come to you and say, you know, tell me about your organization that looks really neat.
Right.
So you're passing it on, and every building needs, you know, somebody,
right,
a go-to person.
Mm-hmm.
So related to that, I think another of the skills that teachers sometimes have to work to acquire if they're going to take a more active role in their school is how they're going to speak up at a faculty meeting, or how they even think about and approach that. And I'm especially interested in that one because I can remember many meetings I've been in where somebody stands up and gives an impassioned plea about something, but clearly they don't have any plan for where that's going to go or what result it's going to have, and it has no result, and they end up frustrated, and so they've said their piece, but it hasn't actually accomplished anything. So I'm just wondering how you, both of you, approach that, and how you think about it, and then when you decide to speak up, or maybe when you decide maybe that's not the best strategy.
It gets tricky. I've really had an evolution with participating in faculty meetings. I felt like the first few years of them, someone would always sort of beat me to the punch of like, oh yeah, I was going to say that, you know, or you've, whatever, and you got called on first, or that sort of thing. So then I thought, well, maybe my voice, you know, someone else has my voice. I don't need to, you know, play an active role. But then I started to think, you know, how are other people viewing me? Are people viewing me as a, you know, important part of this faculty? How does administration view me if I'm just going to sit and, you know, be passive in these, and that's not how I wanted to work within the school. So, but I think it's an approach I've tried to take is to ask questions, provoke more thinking instead of taking a particular stand, or if I don't agree or maybe feel that there's not enough information to make some sort of a decision to sort of push others or to get everyone else thinking about, well, why would we do that, or why are you thinking about that decision? So I try, and I feel like one of my roles is to sort of process what's happening in the feeling in the room and push people a little bit further to think instead of making judgments or state, you know, demands or that sort of thing. So
that's actually an excellent method, I think, because it doesn't threaten,
right,
other people. Whereas if you just take a stand, then everybody starts getting defensive, right,
mm-hmm,
and starts saying, oh yeah?
Right. Well, then there's a couple people who really want it, maybe there's a couple people who don't, and then you've got all these people in the middle who,
right,
you know, aren't, their brains and their opinions aren't being used or valued at that point.
Well, I'm part of the instructional leadership team, and I'm part of it because I'm a bilingual chair, and I foolishly assumed that everybody on the team knows what bilingual education is about and what my role is and what the student, you know, what bilingual education is about. Until an administrator in the school observed a couple of math classrooms and a couple of science classrooms and decided that the way we're doing bilingual education is not what he thought it should be. So he made a phone call to a university with which we have a partnership, because they provide scholarships and classes for us teachers to get certified in ESL and bilingual. And so he wrote an email to the head of bilingual education at this university saying that we would like some professional development to minimize the use of native language within our bilingual program, without consulting with me, without consulting with anybody else in the building. And so this professor, thankfully, didn't call the principal, didn't call the head of, you know, bilingual education. She called one of the instructional coaches because she was a friend. And so this instructional coach from Office of Language and Culture called me, and she left a voicemail. She said, Alex, you have to call me back right now. And I was just, oh my God, what happened? And so when I called her back, she explained what happened. And that's when it struck me that maybe not everybody on the team really knows what bilingual education is about. So we got together with her and we came up with a presentation that would be non-threatening and just educational. You know, I am a part of the I'm the part of the leadership team because I'm a bilingual department chair, and I'm just gonna go over, you know, what bilingual education is about. What are the things you should be looking for when you go into a bilingual classroom? So when you're observing a bilingual teacher, when you're observing bilingual students, what are the things you should be looking for? You know, what are the ways that you can assess, you know, bilingual students? And it raised a lot of questions that I didn't realize were floating out there. So it was just such a great experience. But there was a lot of really interesting questions and conversation that rose out of it that just made me realize how little, you know, I had shared with the ILT team about bilingual. And so we're continuing with that this year. And, you know, I'm going to present in December again. And then this time we're going to make it something that's sustainable. So I will be going to teachers and, you know, helping them work with their bilingual students throughout the year so that things like this don't happen again because somebody has no idea what bilingual education is about.
The story you just told, Alex, illustrates how principals and assistant principals sometimes need education just the way the rest of us do. And sometimes we need to go and talk to principals about issues that are sensitive, either for our own needs or for their needs. Tell me some of the ways you've gone about approaching a principal in a way that's been constructive.
Well, I did that this year for the first time, and I was really nervous because obviously I want my principal to think that I'm a competent teacher and a competent department chair, and the last thing I want is to come into her office and say, like, wah, I have too much work this year. So, but I do have 4 classes, 2 different preps, and the bilingual department chair role, which is different than a regular department chair role because I'm basically the case manager for all of the 300 bilingual students in the building. And so I felt a little overwhelmed, and I felt like if I didn't speak up, then I wouldn't be doing a good job in either one of my roles, in my department chair role or in my teacher role. And I didn't want to completely abandon one or completely abandon the other, but I felt like if I was doing both of them, I would be doing them just not well, both of them not well, if I was doing it by myself. And so I made up a list of all the roles, all the things I have to do as a classroom teacher. And then I made a list of all the things that I have to do as a department chair. And then I made a list of all the things that I would like to do that are not my responsibilities, but they're just good practices. And then I highlighted all the things that I need help with. So there are some things that obviously I have to do by myself, and I can do them. But there are other things like phone calls home because I don't speak Spanish, or just filing, or, you know, just outreach that I would like help on. So I went to her and I said, you know, this is my dilemma. I have talked to the programmer and, you know, there was nothing he could do. I talked to the dean of students and there was nothing she could do. So I'm coming to you and I'm seeing what your opinion is on this. And so she came up with 2 people in the building who she thought could give up part of their time assisting other administrators in the building to assist me. So she took one of the assistants from the dean of curriculum, and so she's helping me a couple of days a week. And then she took the college coordinator, who's also certified in ACCESS, which is a bilingual test, so she could help me, you know, with things like screeners and other things because she's certified. And so that worked out really well. It was very nerve-wracking, and I really didn't want to do it. But as a result, she was able to come up with the best solution. Before this, I went to other teachers, I went to the programmer, I went to everybody, because I really didn't want to seem incompetent by going to the principal. But she came up with the best solution out of all of them, so it was really a positive outcome.
And the key was to get it in writing?
To get it in writing and to tell her exactly what I need help with. So not to come in with this long list and be like, help, you know? Like, it was to say, these are all the things that I do, and I know that I have to do them. These are the things that I would like somebody to help me with. Can you think of somebody in the building that could help me with these particular things? And she did.
And I think another key is if you did actually say it this way, when you said, I want to see what your opinion is about this.
I did.
I mean, that's a really nice way to phrase it that, you know, puts it in that person's court, but in a very open way, you know, that isn't putting them on the spot, you know, or, you know, portraying yourself as unable to handle any of this. It's, I'm consulting you. And that's very cool. Well, we've talked a lot about how teachers relate to each other and their administrators, but then there's also parents. And so I'm wondering how you connect with parents in various ways in order to make your work more effective, easier, more enjoyable, more meaningful.
The big way that I, the biggest bang for the buck, I think, in that realm is I do student-led teacher conferences, so that the kid is in charge of their own conference. So we prepare, and so the kid is leading the conference between me and the parent, and we're all sitting around the table. So in the message I'm trying to get across is, you know, we're all working together to help you be successful at your goals, and again to get the message across to the parents too. In fourth and fifth grade, really, we're really looking for the kids to start taking ownership and working independently, and hopefully the parent isn't helping with the homework and all of that. So to send the message home to the parents that I want to be, the buck needs to stop with me. You don't have to read Sue's essay and look for spelling mistakes. Let me do that. There's enough at home. You have to worry about the teeth brushing and all of the other things, but let me be the person, the gatekeeper of, you know, the work and the effort that's put into that. So that really diffuses a lot. There's relief. You see parents' relief on their face, like, okay, great. I don't have to worry about, you know, if they come and they haven't answered every math problem. So that we're all sort of on the same level playing field, and the kid knows that we're all working in our own realms to support them. So that's, I find, is the most successful tool to work with parents, and it's around the idea of the kid and their particular development.
Can you talk a little more about the roles, because most of us do want parents involved, mm-hmm. and we all want parents involved in their children's education.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you don't want them correcting the spelling, because then it's their spelling
right.
skills, not the kid.
Right.
But then I'm sure you say some things about what kind of role they can take or should take.
Yeah, absolutely. It becomes, the onus becomes mine as far as communicating with the parents, because the kids, you know, at this age level start talking less and about their day to their parents at home. So the parents are really feeling like they don't know what's going on as much as they did in kindergarten and in first grade. So I try and take that extra step too to blog and talk about what's happening during the day, so that they have a context to what their child's school day is like, so that they're aware of maybe the Literature Circle book that they're reading, but they don't feel a need to make sure that they've answered all of the questions. And it's an ongoing conversation. The parents don't all get it at open house night that's now they're evolving into a different role with their kid. It's an ongoing parent education piece of here's how you can help your kid. You know, you can provide a quiet space for them. You can help them manage their outside activities and create a time for them to do their work. And so we talk about different ways that they can support their child, which isn't, you know, sitting next to them reading through each question together.
Something just almost slipped by us there about a blog. Just one little word, and I thought, wait a minute. You do a blog.
We do.
And so this is meant for the parents?
And for the kids, actually. It's for the families. It's one tool that we use to communicate to parents. The kids will write a weekly summary of activities that they did, so it's student-generated. But we also include links for math games or, you know, sometimes we'll post a worksheet or an assignment if they need access to that. We're also posting photographs so that the parents and the kids get to see themselves in their activities or field trips.
And do you write in blog also?
Yeah. Between, I'll write, there'll be upcoming events, but it's mostly student-driven, but one of my goals this year has been to provide articles and take a more active role in educating the parents on areas where they don't understand about homework or why we teach math the way we teach math. So I'm also using it as a tool to communicate with parents on a different level.
So we're talking about how teachers need each other and they need help from the principal. And another way of getting help is through grants, through partnerships. So as a last question, if you could talk about ways in which you've applied for grants or partnerships and how that's worked, that would be very helpful.
And I just wanted to say about that it's so often people in schools tend to really become kind of isolated and focused inward, and that's very understandable because it's intense work.
Right.
And yet there's this larger world out there that sometimes could be really giving you help, but you need to take the step of reaching out.
Right. One of the foundations that we use is the Oppenheimer. And so every year, every team, so the geometry team, the algebra team, the advanced algebra team, writes an Oppenheimer grant. And yes, it's overwhelming. Yes, it takes a long time. But at the end, it's such a great payoff to get, you know, money for supplies. And so the Oppenheimer grant that I most recently wrote was for a bridge project, and students got to build bridges from their scale drawings. So it taught them a lot about, you know, scaling their drawings. It taught them a lot about finances because they had to purchase supplies, and there was percentages involved because, you know, they had late fees. And at the end, the goal was to have the strongest bridge. So it was really fun at the end to just pile on all these weights on it and see which one would not break. And Ted Oppenheimer actually came out for this and watched them do this. So that was really exciting. Another grant that I try to get for my teachers every year is a STEL grant. And it's a grant that allows teachers to get a bilingual ASL endorsement for free from UIC. And so because we have such a large bilingual population, I work with this on this with Office of Language and Culture, so I don't do this by myself, but every year I work with Office of Language and Culture to make sure that some of these grants are available so that I have more and more teachers who are certified in ESL and bilingual.
So, Julie and Alex, thank you so much for sharing these experiences with us. What you've told us about here and in the book really reflect the kinds of strategies that we wanted to share in this book, because it seemed as if they were ones that could really make a difference for teachers so that they were more involved in their school and felt more successful. And we were learning from you that those were, in fact, things that mattered. And our listeners, we hope you've really we hope this has begun to persuade you, if you weren't already a believer in this, that opening up your door and collaborating with your colleagues can really be one of the most satisfying things, along with working with your kids, of course, that you do as a teacher. And, you know, when Alex and Julie started working with their colleagues and spoke up more, what they told us when we talked to them originally working on the book is that they not only help themselves to grow and to feel stronger and better about their work, but this began to affect other teachers in the building, and I think you've heard some of that in this discussion. So that each step they took made the school just a little more friendly and trusting, even if that wasn't originally their intention. And, of course, this made their job a little easier and more fun as well.
So I guess the question is, how do you start doing this yourself? Especially if, like most of us, you're in a less than perfect environment. One popular way is to start by reading a book chapter or article with some fellow teachers. Obviously, we're biased, but a good book to start reading together might be 13 Steps to Teacher Empowerment. Try out one strategy in the book each month, and then compare with your colleagues the differences you've made for yourself and your students. And tell us about it all by commenting on this podcast at the Heinemann Teachers Lounge at Heinemann.com. Julie and Alex, you get the last word.
I think that teachers get into the profession to become role models for students. And I think, as we just learned, by becoming a leader, you not only become a role model for your students, but you become a role model for other teachers in the building. And I think that's really important.
My advice is to just start small, and I think you'd be really surprised at who you can become in your building and within the educational profession. But just to start small, start with one chapter, start with one step, and I think you'll be surprised that you really will grow and like who you become.
Thank you so much.